I'm Michaela Talkington.
And I'm Jo McGrath, and we're the founders of Flourish CIC. And this is the Supporting Women in Social Enterprise podcast. And in this, our first ever episode, we're talking about governance and structure.
Flourish Together is an organisation that supports women to create positive social change. We offer women space, support, training, mentoring and access to funding to develop their ideas themselves and their ventures. We do things differently and have supported over 500 women so far. This podcast came about because we've known for some time that women need to access support in different ways. Accessibility is a big issue, from events that are too expensive to others that are held during times of work or when kids need looking after. Also, people who are running social ventures are often doing it on top of day jobs or other commitments. So having tools and resources they can access in their own time is essential. We've seen that there's a lack of diverse support led by social entrepreneurs themselves, including those that have lived and breathed it. In each episode, we look at a different theme to help you grow your understanding, knowledge and awareness of the wonderful world of social enterprise, innovation and leadership. You'll hear lively panel discussions involving people with lived experience who bring honesty and real insight. We want this podcast to help you on your journey to lead incredible social change. Let's get started. In this episode, we look at all things governance and legal structure when it comes to running and leading social change organisations. On the surface, it sounds like a really dry topic, up there with accounting. But without good governance, the right people running the organisation and the right legal structure, you can come a real cropper and hit big challenges. So, coming up, our producer Vic grills Jo on the things you need to know to keep it simple. In our Flourish Talk section, you'll hear stories from social enterprises set up in different ways. But first, we take you to our recent event where you'll hear from a panel made up of three very different social enterprise organisations who tell us more about their governance and structure.
Like I say, Flourish, its spirit is around sharing experiences and insights, and we've got three fabulous women here tonight to share their experiences of how they've navigated their own organisations, set up, or in fact, how they give advice to others. So without further ado, to start off with, I think it's really important we all know what each of you do. So could I start with you, Michelle?
HERA is a social enterprise. We're a community interest company. We set up in 2016. And we are an arts organisation. That's my background. I'm a textile and surface pattern designer. I set HERA Art up with three other directors in 2016. And our core purpose is to support people with mental health.
Hello, everybody. I'm Chair of Trustees at Emmaus Mosley, and we've been in existence for 20 years. We're a registered charity and also a social enterprise. We offer a home and meaningful work to 26 formerly homeless people who live in a community and work in our social enterprise. They're both on one big site, which is a Victorian mill in Mosley. We have a strong commitment to environmental issues, and our business model is based on collecting and selling donated goods. And the money generated finances the community, but also our charitable work, which we call solidarity, because we have a very strong belief for all of us in the charity in helping others worse off than ourselves. The people who've been homeless who live in our community are called companions because it's their home and they are companions to each other. And they're supported by a qualified staff team. And each companion has an ensuite room, and they're given full board, social activities, they get a small allowance, holiday money, and they get training and qualifications, and they can stay as long as they need. We're a company limited by guarantee and a registered charity. We have a board of 9 trustees, which meets bi-monthly, and companions are encouraged to be involved in all elements of our community. So we have companion observers at our board meetings and they can join in and speak. We have 5 subcommittees. Again, those are made up of representatives of trustees, staff, companions and volunteers. So everybody is involved in the running of the community. Our income generation from our secondhand superstore, we generate about 70% of our income. And the other 30% comes from housing benefit, which the companions sign over to the community. That's part of the agreement when they come to us. And in our current business plan, we are working towards complete self-sustainability.
Hello, good evening. My name is Petra. So I work for an organisation called Cooperatives UK, not to be confused with the Cooperative Group, who are actually one of our members. So Cooperatives UK is a national body, and we're here to represent the 6,000 cooperatives across the country, from small pubs in rural areas to health and social care, to creative, to freelancers coming together. There's a co-op in every place and in every sector. So our mission at Cooperatives UK is to change the world through cooperation, which is quite a grand mission. So we don't necessarily say that everyone has to be cooperative, but we hope that everybody works in a cooperative way. So our members get different services from Cooperatives UK. They get help with setting up their cooperatives. They get help with running their cooperatives. We specialise particularly around legal and governance services, and we provide events and training and networking opportunities. And then I have another hat. I actually work for a cooperative, so I'm on a board of directors as their secretary at a place called Stretford Public Hall. I don't know if anybody's heard of it, but it's in Stretford. It's a beautiful listed building, Edwardian building. It's now owned by the community. We have 800 investor members, and we run events for the local community. So I can hopefully give you a bit of insight from both one side in terms of supporting people who are setting up businesses and cooperatives, and also a little bit of insight from what it means to actually run a community-owned cooperative and what it means to do that on the ground.
Fantastic. What a diverse group of women operate within very different enterprise models. So I hope to dig a bit deeper into these models and kind of find out what are the advantages, disadvantages, challenges, opportunities of them all, both in terms of including people in your decision making and also in that kind of funding side of things. But to start off with, I think I'd like to ask Michelle, because you've set up a community interest company, which is a fairly new-ish, well, I say new-ish, business model or business structure. How did you decide to go down that route, and what made you decide that?
Prior to setting up Her Art, I was a co-founder of a registered charity, another arts charity called Creative Hands Foundation. My experience there was that we were very dependent on grants and directed by grants as well. And I had a lot of learning experiences through that charity. And one of them was that it is better to be more independent as an organisation and being financially independent. That's why when I left the charity and decided to set up Her Art, we explored all the different options and decided to be a KIC because we realised that we could make profit for purpose. So we can act like a business, and all that money raised and that profit, which is a word that I wasn't very comfortable with and still not very comfortable with, but it is necessary that we can then plough some of that money, all of that money, back into our core purpose and the change that we want to make in our community.
Thank you. And how was that experience of setting up a KIC?
We got some support from Nikki Dickens, who, that's what she does. She helps people set up KICs. It was basically an application process. I initially shared my ideas and my vision with some friends and people who I knew and who had supported me in my past. And they quickly came on board, and they're the other three directors who are working with myself. That was all we needed, really. And she did the form filling, and we were registered as a KIC.
What I'd like to know, really, from anyone on the panel, really, is kind of where you're organising. Organisation does go to seek advice and support around governance and legal issues. And Michelle's already mentioned a social enterprise consultant who's part of the Flourish Network called Nikki Dickens.
We're actually part of a federal structure, and there are 29 other IMES communities in this country, but the movement is an international movement, and it started in France. Our founder trustee had already set up the first IMES community in Cambridge. So when he came to us, he had that model. And because it's a federal structure, we have plenty of peer groups and induction and training and meet up and discuss lots of issues. And particularly in the Northwest, There are six other communities, so we meet four times a year and just talk through issues. But when they first set up, I was a volunteer at that stage, I wasn't a trustee. They obviously had picked their founder trustees very carefully for their skills, and I think that's absolutely key. You know, we were buying our property, so we had an estate agent, we had a solicitor, so we had those skills, and I think it's really important to get those key skills initially so that you've got those to call on. And because we're part of a federal structure, we have a central Immerse UK office in Birmingham. They do fundraising to set up new communities, but they also provide HR and legal advice if we need it. We've just recently nobbled a local solicitor to be on call for any legal issues we may have locally. So you've just got to nobble people, basically.
So I think I mentioned briefly that we do give support to people setting up cooperatives, and usually the first question is that people don't know what a cooperative is. So I actually go around the country and I run these workshops called Is a Cooperative for You? And essentially, cooperatives are like any other business. They're there to trade and they're an enterprise and they do make profits. But the difference is what happens to those profits, how they're distributed among the members. And that's really the key thing about cooperatives, and I think that's what makes them so nice, is that they're owned by you guys. You know, you set it up as a group of people and you own it and you make the decisions about how it's run and you reap the rewards of it, but you also share the risk. We also have a wonderful website, thehive.coop, and that has free resources that you can download about setting up cooperatives, and you can also apply for support. The other thing just to say about cooperatives is that people say, well, what's the legal form for a cooperative? And this is the really hardest part. And I have to say, you can be any legal form, and that really confuses the hell out of everyone. So it's like, what, any legal form? And I say, yes, you can be a KIC and a charity and a company limited by guarantee. And essentially what makes you a cooperative is your values and principles and how you have something in your governing document that says you're a cooperative and that you have members and voting rights and what happens to the profit distribution, etc.
The other support that we've received as well, Lloyds Bank have got an initiative called School of Social Entrepreneurs, where you can get funding if you've got an idea. It's really brilliant. I went on that programme. So, yeah, it's fabulous. And another one to plug is Unlimited. They also do a startup setup programme as well, and so you can find out about these online.
Thank you. Michaela wants to grab the mic. There's two bits that I just wanted to add into the learning on some of this, really. One is there'll be people sat in the room thinking, oh gosh, that sounds like a long way from where I am. And I just wanted to throw in an extra legal structure that's not been picked up yet, which is called an unincorporated association. And there's also just being a bog standard sole trader. And so there'll be people who are kind of testing things out, thinking, oh, how do I get started? You know, there's nobody saying you can't just set up in business as a sole trader and test it out. If you're making money or you're going to be trading within 3 months, lots of people set up as a social entrepreneur, as a social enterprise, as a sole trader, as they kind of find their way to kind of which kind of form and format they might want to become. But if they get to the point where they might need some funding or they need to grow beyond themselves, and quite often social enterprises are not one-man bands because you're trying to create social change and you can't do that on your own. So growing your working group, steering group, band of riffraff, or whoever it might be to make the thing work, you can develop a constitution, which is 2 or 3 sides of A4, that then tells people who you are, what you stand for, how you govern yourself as a kind of tier one. And don't get me wrong, there are lots of big unincorporated associations that always stay that way and never evolve into something else, but it's worth knowing about these things and looking them up.
Don't let legal structures and governance stop you from trying stuff out. We all started off as a bit of a side hustle of trying to do some of this stuff we felt that was important, and only through that we discovered it was important, and then we went into the whole legal bit and the governance side of things to make sure that it was done properly. But I wouldn't let it stop you from testing stuff out. I just want to get a sense of some examples, really, of how your governance model has maybe helped you or it's challenged you.
When we started out, it was just a group of people who had some skills who did just write down a constitution, and they didn't set up the legal structure until they were about to buy a property and to start trading and to employ staff. And I think once that legal structure was in, I've reread it. We always give it to new trustees. I'm not sure whether they ever read it. But actually, the answers to everything that you need to know are in there. I don't think it's... We've always done what we needed to do, and it's been quite simple and straightforward. The only challenge for us that I'm aware of within that legal structure was that, as I mentioned, we have companions who come to our board meetings, and they, last year, we were trying to renew our board, so we were looking for new trustees, and one of the companions who had been coming to our board meetings as an observer for about 18 months asked if he could become a trustee. Now, our companions receive a small allowance, so they're beneficiaries, but we wanted to try to have a companion trustee. So we had to actually hold a special meeting to alter our constitution in order to allow that. It's quite a big leap because there's obviously a lot of issues involved, but we did it.
Yeah, we're governed by our Articles of Association, and Nikki helps us set those up as well, and they do work for us. As I said earlier, we are four directors, and three of them are non-executive members, which means that they don't get involved in the day-to-day operations of the organisation, but they are accountable and responsible for what we do. Therefore, you know, it's just me and, thankfully, another friend of mine who's also volunteering all of her knowledge, commitment and support to work on a strategy that works for us. And what that did was it brought us back to doing some really robust work around our vision, mission, our values, and the approach that we want to take going forward. And that's what we're actually working on right now, because that is what is going to be at the heart of our governance and drive our organisation forward. And that has meant that, you know, a bit similar to you, we want to involve our service users, the people who we work with. We want their voice within what we're trying to achieve, rather than it just being us, you know, fabricating our own ideas. You know, we're working a lot around governance and strategy, and we think that's really important to enable us to, number one, be taken seriously, to be professional, and to ensure that we're open and transparent with the way we work, especially when, as a KIC, you can make a profit, but you have a social core purpose.
So quite a lot of cooperatives are set up as worker-owned cooperatives, and initially they might be quite small, there might only be two or three people, you know, they might set up as a KIC or a company limited by guarantee. And I think the interesting thing is when you start growing and maybe taking on more employees, and that's when the democracy and that decision-making might change. One of the things we do a lot of at Cooperatives UK is to help around that decision-making and consensus-making, and we do a lot of training around that because we know we're human beings at the end of the day and we don't always agree, and there's different ways that you can facilitate that and make it work. One of the things I always say, I think you touched on that, was about going back to your vision and your aims, and when it starts getting personal and about your own sort of agenda, is just focus on why you started in the first place and what your aims are, and sort of looking at that. In terms of Stretford Public Hall, that's growing. We're quite new, but we're growing quite quickly. So we initially were just a volunteer board of directors, but we've now taken on a staff team. So that's put us in a different set of minds that we're still grappling with. It's quite a different ball game now, so our governance has had to change to accommodate that. So it's great that we've got staff now, but actually the board suddenly aren't operational and day-to-day, they're having to be strategic, and so we're kind of learning and working our way through that, and we're not getting it right every day, but we're getting there. So it's worth thinking about when you're setting up, although initially you might be quite small, always think about, well, what's the next and what might change and how might we grow and how do we accommodate that? You never stand still, hopefully.
How do you find board members and trustees that sort of understand, have the skills, but understand the vision, mission, value stuff? Have you got any tips for finding these people? And how do you work with them once you start working?
I think that's one of the most difficult things is for, obviously we're charity trustees, but we're directors of a company and we're non-executive directors. So it can be quite difficult getting trustees who understand that it is not their role to be involved in the day-to-day operation. And there is always a tension there. So we're quite careful about our interview process. It's quite often people may have the skills, but it is just a feel of what they're like as a person when you're talking to them. And we do informal interviews and then we do induction. But we do tend to ask people, have they ever visited our community to shop there? What do they understand about what Emmaus is? We have a very strong value set in our charity and we are guided by something called the Universal Manifesto, which was set about up by our founder. And we constantly refer back to that. It is finding people who have that value, but also have the personal skills. It's really, really important that they have some emotional intelligence, actually, in the way they behave as trustees. And I think, as well, when you're a charity, but also a social enterprise, you can get terrible tension on your board between the charitable aims and the business, the importance of the business. When I started, I came from a business background, and when I sat in board meetings, I sometimes thought, what the hell's going on here? They're running a business, but they're talking like social workers all the time. So it is very difficult to get that balance right. And I think it's maturity. It comes to you know what you're looking for in your trustees.
We had kind of like the opposite effect of that. We've got really passionate, committed board of directors who are all working in a field, in a social field, and working on the ground with the actual people who we support. And they've got a passion for the arts, which is what we're about. But there is a skills gap in our directorship, and we do need to do some more focused recruitment of skilled directors. But with our current directors as well, you know, we have had to do some work, and thanks to my colleague Winifred, you know, enabling the directors to see how much responsibility they really do have and how much they are accountable for what happens within our legal structure as a KIC. And also, it was really important. I mean, we do have meetings regularly, quarterly, and when we go there and I speak and tell them all what's been happening and show them all the accounts, and they just go, yeah, that's great. You know, everything's great. And, you know, they've got so much trust and belief in me, which is really valuable, and my colleague as well. But it is also about them really driving this enterprise forward alongside us as well, and really having that constructive input to help us grow as well, rather than really being very silent. So I think we do definitely have a skills gap, and we are looking at recruiting new trustees. So if anybody's interested in what we do, holler at me.
I just want to say one more thing on that financial side. Okay. Trustees have to realise their fiduciary responsibility, and it's really, really important. And when charities go wrong, something like Kids Company, that's because those trustees were not doing their job properly. And again, that's a delicate balance, because you're trying to support your charity, you're trying to support the people who work in it, but you do have an oversight responsibility, and you do have a responsibility to look at the figures and understand them and see what's happening and look down the road, so that you're not going to let your charity or business end up on the rails, really. When we are looking for new trustees, we always give them the accounts, and we do provide, through our federation, we do provide some financial training. You need a really good treasurer, but you've got to try. You cannot delegate that responsibility to just the treasurer or the chair. You have to accept responsibility across the board for that. It's really important.
What are the stepping stones to the point that you do the stuff? You know, you're on your own at the start, or you're a small group. then you think, right, you know, we need a minimum of three if we're going to look for certain funding opportunities. Other social enterprises never need funding. They just start trading from the off. My rule of thumb is, in an ideal world, you know, you need 3 to 5 trustees in the first few years for that diversity, to have different ambassadors and champions, and to not be doing everything yourself. But when you get to the point of clearly Emmaus and some of the other organisations that grow, it's a different beast, and you're looking at 5 to 12 trustees to kind of strategically be accountable and be autonomous and independent and transparent via, you know, a much larger set of income and impacts that you're looking to create.
Also accepting that you will lose people along the way. Some people are very comfortable in charities, and when you start talking about enterprise behaviour or profit, it's just not for them, and you've got to accept that. They might never get that, and that's fine. There will always be a place for charities, but I agree, there's so many, you know, don't even mention austerity, Brexit. We've not mentioned Brexit yet. I've had 3 hours Brexit-free time. It's lovely. Social enterprise isn't a thing. It's a behaviour, it's an attitude, it's a way of doing things, I guess. And
future of business.
Yeah, so you can be a charity, and I worked for a charity for many years, and Martha, chief exec, was really enterprising, and she said, we can't change the world if we can't balance the books, you know. So we had to adapt as the world around us adapted and the environment changed. We had to become more enterprising, otherwise we wouldn't exist, we wouldn't be able to affect our mission, we wouldn't be able to change the lives of people in our communities. So it was one of those sad facts, and the governance evolved in line with that attitude and behaviour change, that we had to get more business people involved whilst not taking drifting from our mission, which is a tough balance. It really is, and I don't think we'll ever get it right, but we can try our best. It's been great to have your attention and your insights and your contributions, and particularly the panel, so thank you.
A really interesting discussion from three very different social enterprise setups, which really does go to show that not one size fits all, especially when it comes to governance and structure within a social enterprise. That was recorded at a recent Flourish event, and we have a programme of great events coming up. To find out what's on, simply visit eventbrite.com and search Flourish CIC.
You're listening to the Supporting Women in Social Enterprise podcast with Flourish Together CIC. Coming up, we get an expert view on all things governance and legal structure from our Jo. But first, our roving producer at large, Vic, was at an event at Manchester Library recently, which we'll cover in a later episode, where she spoke to a bunch of ladies from the Flourish Together network with more stories of how they set up their social enterprise.
My name's Sis, and I'm the caretaker and founder of Idle Women. Idle Women's an arts and social justice project, and we create spaces for women and girls in places where they're least imagined.
So tell me about how you set up at the minute.
We are set up as a community interest company, which means that we're not governed by the charity board, but we have certain sort of legal structures that are in place that means that any money that we make, we put back into the community. So we're not a non-profit organisation. We have a governance structure which consists of 2 caretakers or directors on the ground, soon to be 3, and 2 directors that are quieter and less present, but they are also very involved. And then we have 8 women who are our management board and advisory committee. They don't necessarily have the same legal responsibility as you would if you were a trustee in a charity, but they are just as supportive and as necessary.
Do you think that having those advisory boards is important to a not-for-profit organisation?
I think it's essential. Being a young not-for-profit organisation is bloody hard work. Often teams are very small because we're not making any money. You know, we don't have big teams like some of the charities do. You know, they have massive teams. So, in fact, having these women on our advisory committee are essential for, you know, everyday decisions, wider long-term development decision-making, and also general support. We're a women's org. It's hard, and it's great to have that sort of sense of sisterhood and expertise in different areas. So, for example, some of our advisory board are development directors in, you know, quite esteemed institutions. One woman lived in a van for 30 years and is an activist. And also, you know, we commit to having at least 50% BME women in our organisation, and we have probably, I think, about 80% in our advisory committee, and that's very important to us.
And when you were set up as a CIC, what was the most difficult part about that process?
We couldn't do it on our own. Initially, we tried to set up as a charity. I'm really grateful that they rejected our application, actually, because I'm very glad that we're not a charity. We sought legal advice. There's a sort of social enterprise organisation called Bells and Braithwaite. They were really, really great at helping us think about what our core values and principles are and what our mission is. And they said, actually, if you're a CIC, you have more autonomy over what you're doing. It's harder to get funding. Charities are very easily funded, CICs less so. I guess there's something about the old, if you imagine the kind of old philanthropic structures, the Victorian child with his hat out, and that's when charities established, and it's still very much like that. Whereas a CIC is, you know, we don't ask for money, we ask for women to join us and become part of a movement. And so being a CIC affords us that freedom and that optimism.
Hi, I'm Dion Taylor from SavvyGuest. I'm the founder and I'm a local girl from Manchester. SavvyGuest has set itself up to facilitate pre-career meetups between individuals and people in employment or business, so we can get a foot in the door to just have an insight into those particular careers and job roles, which we don't normally get, because unless you know somebody who works there, it's really hard to get your foot in the door. So we're breaking down those barriers. SavvyGuest, everything about it has social aims. We are a business, a private business, so to speak, but with social aims to it. We're a business that fully looks at social value, corporate social responsibility, and all the sort of work ethics around social value.
Some of our listeners will be trying to set up a social enterprise. Do you think there's clear information out there about setting up a social enterprise?
I think there's a lot of information. I think the problem is navigating the information, because there's so many businesses who are starting up as social enterprises, but it's what is a social enterprise? What does it mean to you? And I don't specifically think I fit in a particular box, a tick box or a check box. However, if you speak to startups who are starting social enterprises, they're all doing good things and not necessarily fitting into the criteria, what looks like a social enterprise on paper, but they are all doing pretty much social enterprise work. I think it's a bit of a struggle, and unless you've got platforms or, you know, networks like Flourish to engage with and navigate through that, I think it could be quite difficult.
When you were setting up SavvyGuest, what was that time like for you?
I think for SavvyGuest, I knew what I wanted it to do. I think I didn't want to limit myself to the structures in terms of the legal structures.
I'm Halima Ravage. I'm a senior lecturer in nutritional sciences, and I set up MedMunch in 2011, which is a sort of a student-led social enterprise based at Manchester Metropolitan University. At the moment, it is a project within the environment team, but it is based on a social enterprise model. And at some point, we would like to, you know, kind of do a spin-off. I mean, within the legal structure of the university, we still haven't got there, so we are still a little bit ahead of time there. Kind of like the students have gone on to set up their own social enterprises. So it was more to train others to think in entrepreneurial fashion and to think out of the box and to kind of, I don't know, push for change and do things differently. And actually, originally, it was to enhance the employability skills of the students. So I think it has done that and more.
So there'll be some listeners listening to this podcast now who are working within the constraints of a bigger organisation. In terms of governance and structure, has that held you back, or has that been a a positive or?
I think to start with, when I set it up, there was a lot of red tape, and I think it's rightly so because universities need to have all those, you know, kind of legal structures, the paperwork, and, you know, because they're accountable and they have to have rules and regulations. And, you know, with regards to entrepreneurial journeys, sometimes, you know, kind of like you are going to be the disruptor, the rule breaker, the change maker. So, yes, but within, you know, kind of like that big organization, I found huge network and matrix of people who came forward to help out. So if you do want an animation artist, you've got him. If you want a lawyer, a commercial barrister, if you want a mentor, a counselor, somebody to give you guidance on certain parts of research, there is always someone to, you know, to be there. So you practically are working with 4,000 people as part of your so-called organization, but you are a one-woman band. But, you know, they're always there, like they're invisible supporters. The positives have always outweighed the little niggling, you know, kind of negatives. And I think, you know, when you start anything, because it's going to be different, you will always get the barriers, the naysayers, the death eaters, whatever, you know, you're going to call them. At the beginning, they ignore you, maybe they kind of reject you, but then they ask you how you've done it. So I think we are at that stage that people are actually, you know, replicating what we are doing. So it's fantastic. I definitely would highly recommend universities as places of, you know, kind of growth and pushing boundaries and youth. There's so many young people. We've got 38,000 students. So, you know, if you're not going to be doing it surrounded by 38,000 students, where are you going to do it? You know, I feel as if I'm part of a bigger organization, but if I do need to go back into my shell and do things on my own, I know that that's there as well. So I think it's having the best of both worlds.
You're listening to the Supporting Women in Social Enterprise podcast with Flourish Together CIC. Coming up, our producer Vic grills Joe on the things you need to know to keep it simple.
What are the biggest misconceptions about being a social enterprise?
I think the biggest misconception is that social enterprise is a legal structure, and it's not. It's a sentiment, it's a way of working, it's a thing that we all aspire to be, and then we put the legal structure on the back of that that suits how that social enterprise is going to perform and operate. Very often I have people that will come to me who say, I want to be a CIC, I want to be a company limited by guarantee or a co-op or whatever, and I'm like, well, why do you want to be that? Is that going to meet the needs of your organization, short, medium and long term? And very often they can't answer that question. So I go, okay, we need to understand what you're going to do and what the income's going to look like and things like that. We need to consider a whole bunch of stuff before we even get to legal structure. So I think that's the thing. If you want to be a social enterprise, brilliant. I think the main things are that you have a really clear social mission, that you are accountable to somebody. So it's not just you kind of going along and making money and spending it how you will. There's got to be that transparency and accountability. You really need to be investing your profits back into your organisation or furthering your social mission or investing it in another social enterprise. You can't be just taking profits out of it just for yourself, obviously. Shareholding companies are never deemed a social enterprise and they will never be recognised as a social enterprise. Social enterprise is something that predominantly earns its income through trading. It's got a really clear social mission. It's very transparent. It's autonomous of the state.
When I was speaking to some ladies, some vox pops that we'll hear in this, one of the ladies said that I'm a limited company, so I can't be a social enterprise.
Yeah, another misconception, yeah. But you can. There's ways of doing that. You can be a limited company by guarantee. And again, it's down to what income strategy you have, and that'll change over time. Initially, you might be looking for some grant funding, and not all grant funders will fund a company limited by share or a company limited by guarantee. It depends on what your funding strategy is. And then that might change. You might initially be wanting grant funding, and then move to a really kind of trading model. Again, it's just being really clear as to what you are and what you want to do. And that's not just in the immediate, it's actually longer term.
Well, let's talk about structure, actually. So say, for example, myself, I want to start a social enterprise. Do I right away register as a charity?
No, please don't do that. if you think about it as just a business, take the social out of it for now. As a business, to survive, you need to know who your market is. So who's going to buy your stuff? Who's going to benefit from your stuff? And the people that benefit and the people that buy from it can be quite different people. So in the social world, we say beneficiaries or service users or clients. So the people that are going to really benefit from what you're delivering. But they might not necessarily in the social world be able to pay for that. They might not be able to afford it. There might be other barriers to them paying for it. So who's going to pay for it? Because someone's got to pay for it at the end of the day. Is that going to be a third party agency like a local authority, a housing association? Because otherwise you would be maybe a charity that's reliant on donations, fundraising, grants, etc. But to be a social enterprise, you have to be trading in some capacity.
It just sounds like a business plan.
Yes, it is. And there's some really useful tools out there to do this stuff that isn't intimidating. Because I think people, when they think about business plans, they think about those that do go into banks and ask for big investment and go for loans and things like that. Well, actually, a business plan is basically dumping all your ideas on one page and making sure it makes sense and that you can articulate it to somebody else who might want to invest in it or might want to buy something off you. So Social Business Canvas is a really good tool. You can just Google it, download a PDF, and it literally asks you to look at a number of things. One is, what resources do you need to make this thing happen? That's people, finance, and maybe if it's premises or whatever, some physical space. Then you start to look at who else do you need to work with? Because the most sensible thing and the easiest thing is to work with other people on this stuff, because there's other people with other assets and strengths out there. So see who else is out there. Who could you work with? And who could you maybe get in really early on to help co-design some stuff? Because that's also another really helpful way. Save you a lot of legwork and also start to build a movement around your idea right from the very beginning. The other thing is you want to know about what are the key activities I'm going to deliver and where do they need to be delivered and who's going to deliver them? Because you might have a great idea, but you might not have the skills or the training or expertise to deliver that yourself. Then you need to think about who you're going to support, who you're going to be the beneficiaries. And then you need to think about how you're going to get to them. Because some people, you know, it's really easy to get to the beneficiaries that are around them. They're easily accessible. But if you're thinking about doing work in prisons or doing work elsewhere where there's, you know, barriers to access, you need to be thinking about what agencies you can use to access those. Then you need to think about who the customers are, so who's going to buy this stuff. And then there's two propositions that you really need to think about really clearly. Okay, what's your social value proposition? What's the difference you're going to make in the world when this thing comes off? But the other one is, what's your customer value proposition? And they can be quite different. Mm-hmm. So your value proposition to somebody might be, I'm going to get you off the streets into proper accommodation and help you find a job. But the proposition to the customer, which might be the local authorities, I'm going to solve your homelessness problem, your street homelessness problem. And I'm going to save you lots of money because the people that are street homeless are really maybe accessing a lot of services that are already heavily burdened. So how can I help you to find a solution that's long-term sustainable? It's that type of thing. And that's what your social business canvas will help you with. But it also as well looks at that bit about the finance bit.
I imagine then that all helps sort of define the structure to start off with.
Mm-hmm. But if you've got a very clear income stream and trading kind of customer base, you know, people that are willing to put money to this, then that would be a social enterprise. In your plan, if you're thinking, I only really want to affect the community in my geography, I never really want to go national or global on this. So maybe your income strategy is that you'll find some upfront grant to help deliver and test what you do and then turn that into a bit of a trading model. But if you're thinking of scaling it massively nationally, you know, globally, it might be that you might be looking for some social investors later on down the line. And again, you know, your legal structure will enable or be a barrier to social investment. So again, just think about longer term. And also one of the things around the admin burden on you gets very different dependent on which legal structure you go with. Company limited by guarantee, you're just reporting back into company's house. That's one kind of master or mistress that you have to satisfy. But when you go to a community interest company, statement report alongside your accounts every year, which isn't onerous at all. It's quite a good time to reflect on what you've been doing. So there's that. I think charities are a whole different ballgame. You know, charities commission, you sort of work into two masters or mistresses, and you've got a lot to work with because you've got to service your trustees. You've got to ensure that your trustees are working in the interests of the charity. It's quite a lot of quite a big ask, I think. So I think, you know, I just always say get some advice on this, and I will have a disclaimer. I am not a lawyer. These are just my thoughts on some of the experiences and knowledge I've gained along the years. I would always say just check some of this out first before you embark on anything. And, you know, there's some great support out there that's free and accessible.
Let's move on to governance.
Very often, social entrepreneurs are entrepreneurs. The go-getters, they're kind of focused on their mission and their thoughts. And how do you then introduce some other people into a very private party and get them on board? It's quite a step change.
So each legal structure will have a different governance structure.
Obviously, yeah. Charities have trustees, companies, CICs have directors. And they can be twofold. They can be directors or non-executive directors. And basically what that means is that a director is one that is named on your company's house as a director of that company. So they share the risk and liability for that company. Non-executive directors can be those that are, they're not actually named as a director of the company, but they're there to advise and support and guide, and are generally quite strategic. And directors, again, you can have directors that are signed up to your company with company's house, and they could be the doers as well, delivering stuff, or they might not be. For example, with Flourish, when we created the community interest company, we were obviously wanted three directors to start off with. We thought that's all we could manage at that time. So Nicola and I and another colleague, Anne Strachan, became signed up directors at company's house. Nicola and I are very much on the delivery of Flourish, so we were very much involved in the day-to-day, and Anne was there to support and challenge and strategise with us when she was available, but very much a kind of not a hands-on operational director. So that worked for us at the time. We're now moved into, I think we're moving into year three of us being a proper community interest company, because before that we were just doing stuff, testing stuff. We had no legal structure. And now we've reached a point where we just really want to move the business on. Want to move the enterprise on, and so we made a decision that we would see if we could recruit some more directors to help us get to where we want to be. We did a call out and we got some great applications back. We had an application process and we had some great applications back, and then we interviewed them, and we've just taken on two new directors and two new non-executive directors with different skills, but all are really aligned to the values and the mission of Flourish. We're also really keen that our governance reflects our customer and our network. So we really wanted a more diverse board, as it were, a group of directors, and we've got that now. What I love about our directors now are that two of the new ones have been part of the network, have been in receipt of the services of Flourish and have been part of some of our events and have helped us. Certainly one of them has volunteered on a number of events that we've put on. So it's been really good to have that. I think you can't shape a service or a product or a business that serves a particular community and not have that reflected in those that are making the decisions of where that business goes. I think, you know, you don't have to go down the recruiting official directors. You could have that check in with your beneficiaries through advisory work, whether that is through a more formalised advisory board or whether it's just through focus groups throughout.
So good governance is just a nice to have. Or is it dead important?
Yeah, it is really. Yeah, it is super important. I think it can seem like a bit of a burden and a bit of a drag, but actually if you get the right people around, it can really help propel your business on. I think key to that is not just going for governance for people that have got a particular skill. They need to share the values. And when we went through our questions for the director interviews, we threw in a couple of values-based questions, and we'd do that if we were recruiting anyone. We'd go down the values-based recruitment route. And you'll find that. I think you'll find that there's more and more people that are working in different sectors that do share your values and wanting to be part of some of this work because it makes them feel good.
There's so much information out there. How does our listener navigate through
all that? That's a good question, yeah. Yeah, don't get bogged down with websites. I think speak to people that have gone through a governance. You just can't get that off a website. And even those that have had a really bad experience are probably the best people to speak to because they've learnt the most. And, you know, if you go to somebody and they're trying to force you down a particular route and you don't feel comfortable with it, step away and maybe get another set of bit of advice off somebody on it. You need to feel completely comfortable with it. Don't be scared of it. It's not that scary and it can be very, very helpful and it is important. So maybe get a mentor perhaps. With Flourish, you know, we often touch upon it across our different events, but we do run monthly peer learning events. So come along to that because you're likely to bump into someone that's going through what you're going through. I think that's why Flourish came about, is because there's lots of stuff out there. We found it ourselves, you know, creating our own social enterprise. We get this question asked loads of times and we think, well, actually, let's just put everyone in a room occasionally, maybe once a month, and hopefully people find the support they need.
Jo, you're a fountain of knowledge for all social enterprise. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
I really hope you enjoyed listening and that we sparked some questions for you. When it comes to governance and legal structures, it's so important you take your time and don't rush into things. Get the right people around you and weigh up your options.
We really hope you enjoyed the first episode of our Supporting Women in Social Enterprise podcast and that we've helped you to demystify the murky world of governance and structure for your social venture. To tell the world about Flourish in this podcast or perhaps suggest a subject you'd like us to discuss, please connect with us on Twitter at FlourishCIC.
A big thanks to Michelle from Her Art CIC, Petra from Cooperative G, Fran Hurst from Emmaus Mosley, and a big thanks to you for listening. There's lots of ways for you to get involved with what we do here at Flourish. As well as our monthly events, we have our Flourish Mentorathon coming up in July. It's a 12-hour mentoring marathon and we're looking for both mentors and people who have great ideas for social change to take part. If you're based in the northwest of England and need support, visit our website www.flourishtogether.org.uk. The next episode is all about careers in social enterprise and features Eve Holt, who's a Manchester councillor, director of a social enterprise and former lawyer. We can't wait to see you then.
Supporting Women in Social Enterprise is a Mike Media production and is produced and edited by Vic Elizabeth Turnbull.